Dale, good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the first hour tonight, the views of Joel Skousen, our good friend from World Affairs Brief. And the nice thing about Joel is he analyzes what's going on in the world. He doesn't accept what everybody else is saying, because, believe me, most of what most people are saying just isn't true. There's a planned program of disinformation and confusion out there, and, well, you just need a guide to get you through all the darkness and that's out there, and Joel does a wonderful job, and I always look forward to our programs. Joel Skousen, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure and an honor for me to be on your show, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you pick up and tell us what you're looking at and what you think the important issues are today?
Well, your audience is getting a preview of tomorrow's World Affairs Brief. A day early. I've got it completed. It's ready for editing. But the big story is a tragic one. It's a follow-on really from last week's brief on this detainee bill. And now that I've had a chance to read the 80-some pages of finding there's a nightmare inside this, this bill is definitely worse, much worse than the Patriot Act, Dr. Stan. Buried inside its pages is a little-used constitutional provision that allows Congress to strip away from the judiciary their jurisdiction over certain areas of law. In this bill, Congress not only made citizen dissidents subject to arrest as enemy combatants, determined solely by a secret military tribunal, but they allowed for their indefinite detention, stripped them of any habeas corpus rights to demand the government show cause for holding them as prisoner. And now, no judge or court of the land can rule on this law and say it's unconstitutional because Congress has made it exempt from judicial review.
You think that the Congress really understands that this is not necessarily applying to terrorists, to foreign terrorists, to Islamic terrorists. It's applying to the American citizens who show hostility or disagreement with the government? Because isn't that what it really says?
It really is. I mean, a good portion of Congress, Dr. Stan, are attorneys. If they'd even bothered to read this bill, which I don't think many of them did, they would have seen immediately that that definition of what can be a terrorist is very, very broad. The entire disinformation about this bill was just appalling. The media kept billing this thing as a major compromise, defending detainees' rights. Talking about detainees' rights. Not only do detainees not have any rights in this bill, it's come to find out that we as citizens don't have any rights if you happen to be deemed by a secret military tribunal an enemy combatant. They arrest you. There's nothing you can do. You can't make a phone call. You aren't declared your rights. They don't have to charge you with anything. Your family, if they go looking for you, might ask the government. They don't have to tell them that they have you in custody. You can disappear forever in this bill, and it can't be ruled unconstitutional.
And I think what's so significant is the fact that it has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism. It has to do with opposition to the power of the state. And they're using the threat of Islamic terrorism to destroy the very essence of our constitutional guarantees of individual freedom under God. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. We'll read the specific language when you're ready after the break.
All right, fine. Well, I think so, ladies and gentlemen, it's so important you know what's in this bill, because you're not going to hear this elsewhere. And we're going to be back in just a moment with Joel. And if you want to get a complete tape of this program, of course, they are available through Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. Well, Joel, go ahead and pick up the story.
You know, conservatives have tried to get Congress for years to limit the to use this constitutional provision. It does give Congress the power to limit the jurisdiction of the courts in certain areas that they say we don't want the courts messing with this. So conservatives have tried to get Congress for years to limit the jurisdiction of the courts, who've always dismantled state anti-abortion laws. And Congress has always refused. They have never, I mean, looked upon this as this would be improper to ever limit the jurisdiction of the courts. So here we have, finally they used that power, but only to dismantle our civil liberties. And here's the language. No court, justice, or judge shall have jurisdiction to hear or consider any claim or cause of action whatsoever, including any action pending on or filed after the date of the enactment of the Military Commissions Act of 2006, that's this bill, relating to the prosecution, trial, judgment of a military commission under this chapter, including challenges to the lawfulness of procedures of military commissions under this chapter. In other words, they can't even rule on whether it's constitutional or not.
And so, really, you forget about our courts, forget about the Supreme Court, forget about the Constitution. What they've said is the courts can't determine whether what we are doing has any constitutional bearing. There are, then, no constitutional protections for anybody that is accused of being hostile to the government, and that then becomes the definition of terrorism, having nothing to do with Islamic terrorism. That's what's so amazing. And where's the outcry from the New York Times and the Washington Post and our conservative Wall Street Journal?
Yes, this only came out really yesterday. Alex Jones was one of the first to pick up on this, and then I read it and analyzed it. And you know, a lot of people think, of course, as you mentioned, that this is only aimed at foreign terrorists. But in the provisions of law, it specifically targets those who, quote, have an allegiance or duty to the United States. Now, that can only refer to citizens. Terrorists don't have any duty or allegiance to our government. Here's the language. Quote, any person subject to this chapter who, in breach of an allegiance or duty to the United States, knowing they're intentionally aids an enemy of the United States, shall be punished as a military commission under this chapter may direct. Now, that's any citizen, because those are the only people who have allegiance or duty to the United States. Knowingly, intentionally aids an enemy of the United States, I mean, that is so broad. I mean, you or I, Dr. Stan, for criticizing the government could easily be declared aiding an enemy of the United States. And brought before a military commission, which is essentially a star chamber, in secret, arrested and put away for the rest of our lives, and no
one will be right back. Hold on. Well, Dr. Stan here, and of course what Joel points out is if you read the bill, you will find out that it applies to people who have an allegiance to the United States. Now, that would not be a terrorist. No terrorist would have an allegiance to the United States. So what they, in essence, are saying is anybody who has an allegiance to the United States, a citizen of the United States, you know, certainly then who has this, and what would the exact terminology that they use, that they, what can they do to these people who disagree with government?
May be punished as the military commission under this chapter may direct. And it's just, it's wide open. Anything they want to direct, and it's all in secret, there's no law, there's no appeal, no court can touch the decision.
There's no habeas corpus.
There's no habeas corpus. There's unlimited detention. They never have to charge you. They can simply punish you and put you away for the rest of your life. And some American wrote this bill. You know, this is incredible to me, Dr. Stan.
I don't believe the person who wrote it was an American, but he may claim to be. However, this is anybody who's an American would never come up with such language. Only those who want to have a dictatorship in what was once the land of the free would talk about, you know, this idea of unlimited detention and no appeal to any court because they have invoked Article 3, Section 2. Taking away that right to any one of us to an appeal to a court of law.
Well, I'm afraid these were Americans who do this, and believe me, Dr. Stan, there are plenty of people who will sell out liberty just to be yes man or to keep their salary and their place of position and power within government. We learned that in Nazi Germany. Many good people went along to get along, and it's amazing how they salved their conscience by saying, I'm just doing my duty. I'm a hired lawyer for the White House, and they tell me what to write, and I write it. It's very, very amoral. You know, and this these provisions, of course, are being used right now. Greg Palast was recently hounded by Homeland Security after they accused him of potentially giving terrorists key information about U.S. critical infrastructure. That was part of the Patriot Act. When filming, he was filming Exxon's Baton Rouge refinery, showing something about the fact that they claimed that it was shut down and it was actually in full operation. But clear photos of this refinery are publicly available on Google Maps. You can get any photos you want about that. So how can they, you know, harass somebody about providing information to terrorists just because they're filming something when it's available on the Internet?
No, what happened to Gregory? Is he all right?
Well, oh, sure, he's fine, but they harassed him and they threatened him with legal action if he didn't turn over his video. I mean, this is just Gestapo-type tactics. Even the New York Times stated that legislation introduced is dangerously broad in its definition of illegal enemy combatants. And the bill could, quote, subject legal residents of the United States as well as foreign citizens living in their own countries to summary arrest and indefinite detention with no hope of appeal. The president could give the power to apply this label to anyone he wanted. So the New York Times did at least sound some warning on this, but it's amazing it doesn't get any play in the press. I mean, the news media should literally be jumping up and down with anger about this. It should be embarrassing the president. And yet everyone's asleep.
Well, I'm glad you've had a chance to read it, and at least our listeners will be the alert of the elite out there, the elite of the alert, but unfortunately, they're going to have to learn all about this, and then they're going to have to get this information out. And, of course, for our listeners, you'll certainly want to read the World Affairs brief that Joe put out. I guess he'll publish it today, and that is available. Can people get one free copy of that?
They can. They can email me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com, and I'll be happy to send them free of charge sample briefs, including this one.
All right, fine. And let me tell you, I read it every week when it comes out. I always look forward to it because Joel has the time and the persistence to go through and read these things, which I find very hard to do during 5 hours of talk radio a day. Okay, fine. Well, right, you just pick up the ball and run with it. I'll sit here and listen.
Well, you know, this is, as Joseph Watson said from Alex Jones' website, he says, this is our generation's version of the Alien and Sedition Acts, those terrible laws that were passed by Britain in the Revolutionary War, meaning that anyone who said anything against the government was guilty of treason. Here's the quote from the Act. Coerced evidence would be permissible, that means torture, would be permissible if a judge considered it reliable. This is already, of course, a contradiction in terms, and coercion is defined in a way that exempts anything done before the passage of the 2005 detainee bill. Now, the bottom line is that this bill is now beyond the reach of the courts. Its ability to declare these things unconstitutional is gone. The first military tribunals were banned by the Supreme Court for being in violation of habeas corpus. Congress has no right to pass law in violation of the Constitution, so the law is still illegal, even if the Supreme Court isn't able to declare it as such. You know, there's a doctrine of law, is that any law that is unconstitutional is null and void and is never in effect, because no law, by definition, can be against the Constitution. They're just simply making sure that no one can declare it unconstitutional because it cannot come up for judicial review. But the fact will avail us nothing once arrested and incarcerated in some military brig, the U.S. version of the Tower of London. You know, the president is now above the Constitution. In reaction,
what we really have, is an imperial presidency. What we have is another King George.
Yes, and unfortunately, it's not just an evil king that God can strike down. It's a whole mass of powerful individuals, which I call the powers that be, that work and control George Bush as their script reader in chief. And they're the ones calling the shots. This is a much larger conspiracy, and people ought to be very, very concerned. Debbie Kidd, that feisty commentator from News With You, said, this past week we saw the traitorous Republicans pass new legislation to protect their backsides and Bushes from being charged with war crimes. To say this latest move by Congress is beyond any horror most of us hardened warriors said wouldn't happen is the understatement of the century. She's as shocked as I am, Dr. Stan. Actually, the purpose, in my belief, the purpose of this bill is much worse than merely providing immunity for government professionals and politicians, which it does. This legislation clearly provides the mechanism to establish a hidden system of arrest and incarceration for dissidents. And as I pointed out in a brief in the previous week, I highlighted one of the new transfer station / prison facilities that was built in Indiana on a rail line. This is very, very scary when you have facilities being built to handle large numbers of people en route to prison somewhere.
And I think the fact that they, and anybody who doubts this should certainly go up on the Internet and look up, just Google in Halliburton, $385 million detention camps. The fact that they authorized $385 million for Halliburton, which is, of course, Dick Cheney's former company, to build detention camps in America. We have to ask, what in heaven's name are they thinking of? Or is there something they don't want the American people to know? Why would they be spending $385 million to build detention camps?
That's right. And I want to warn people, though, that on the Internet are old lists of suspected detention camps, and most of them are bogus. I don't know who put those lists on there, but they got copied many times into many different websites. I checked out a lot of them, and, for example, the list of camps that claim to be refurbished Japanese prisoner of war camps in America. Every one of those is bogus. Not one of those camps has been remodeled or refurbished. They're still just out there in the open desert like they were for many years. So there's a lot of disinformation out there meant to discredit the movement, but believe me, I have found five or six major campsites that are ready and waiting, and so the threat is very real, even if it has been overstated at times.
Well, I think that they're intentionally putting out disinformation. I think that the intelligence communities or somebody is putting out faulty information, so people who pick up on it will be discredited. So we have to be so careful what we come up with.
That's right. I want to end this section with a strongly worded rebuttal to NPR's interview of Professor John Yoo. Now, John Yoo is the Asian-American, U.S.-educated lawyer who's now a professor at one of the major law schools, who wrote a lot of the provisions of the Patriot Act in this act. And they interviewed him in a very positive light, defending all the needs for the president to put forth this detainee bill. And, of course, he didn't, he assured everybody this doesn't apply to citizens. They got a strongly worded rebuttal from U.S. federal judge Leif M. Clark in San Antonio, Texas, who said, quote, "The very idea of holding anyone without trial, without the right to see the evidence that was used to justify naming them an enemy combatant, and depriving them of the ability to challenge why they're even there in prison is so repugnant to a constitutional democracy that I'm shocked this man, a professor, actually claims to be defending American values." He continued, he said, quote, "I also quibble with Yoo's contention that U.S. citizens have the right to habeas corpus review. I have read the law. The president can form his own tribunal, which can determine who is an enemy combatant, not just an alien enemy combatant. The decision of that tribunal would not be subject to habeas review by any court. How easy it would be for a president to use such a law to make his political enemies simply disappear," unquote.
As the president has said, you're either with us or you're against us. And I really am very, very concerned when a president wants to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., because, of course, who is going to limit that power? And let's imagine that George Bush is truly a fine gentleman and honest, but what about the next president? I mean, would you really want to give that sort of a power to Bill Clinton or to Hillary Clinton? We'll be back in just a moment here with Joel Skousen here at the Radio Liberty Network. We'll go right ahead, Joel.
Well, the next issue, Dr. Stan, is The border fence, I found out today, is a fraud. Even after after looking at the specific language of the Homeland Security bill, it wasn't a border fence bill. It was a general omnibus Homeland Security funding bill signed into the law by the president at a lavish ceremony in Arizona, ringed by Republicans and Arizona Governor Napolitano. Everyone was getting in on the act and praising the president for finally getting religion and building a fence. But I'm convinced he doesn't intend to ever build the fence. Here's the details. The $1.2 billion is earmarked in the bill for, quote, a security barrier. It never specifically mandates any fence to be built. There is no specifications for the fence. It just says a security barrier. Bush could and probably will direct all of that $1.2 billion to go to Boeing, which has the high-tech contract for electronic surveillance equipment on the border. But there is no mandate in this bill to build a fence. I think it's just a ruse. Others seem to agree with this assessment. Critics, according to the Houston Chronicle, claim, quote, the 700-mile fence doesn't include a penny to actually build the double-layered barrier, estimated to cost anywhere from $2.2 billion to $9 billion. Now, by the way, this is an outrageous sum. It's a figure meant only to deter construction. Frank Sherry, executive director of the National Immigration Forum, says this is about incumbent protection, voting for something that's popular. It's not about border protection. They don't intend to build the fence. And I think Frank Sherry is right. The Bush administration and the Republicans have crafted this bill to give a token nod to enforcement and to quell the grassroots demand to stop illegal immigration. They have no intention of building it. Even Mexican presidential spokesman Ruben Aguilar claimed the fence won't be built, and he should know. His boss, Vicente Fox, and Bush have been in collusion on this issue for years. Even Senator Majority Leader Bill Frist, who's no friend of the fence, went along with this legislation just so that he could tell his constituencies he voted for enforcement. But he claimed in his first speech, now this is merely a first step. His real interest is in the second step, an amnesty and jobs program, you know, right in lockstep with the president. The president, pandering to the Arizona congressional delegation, couldn't help promoting his amnesty workers program as well and denigrated the fence. He said, quote, enforcement alone won't stop illegal immigration. And of course, what he means by enforcement really isn't directed to the fence, because enforcement, given the restrictions against effective enforcement that are in place with INS Border Guard, the National Guard, and state and county police agencies, certainly isn't ineffective. But a fence is really not the same as enforcement. It goes one step better. Enforcement takes place after the legal entrance is made and you have to round people up and ship them back home. A well-defined fence flat out stops people from entering at all, and essentially you don't need to take care of enforcement because they can't get in. So a fence is much more effective even than enforcement. But I don't think it's going to get built.
Well, I suspect that so much of what we're seeing today is all about a perception. It's all to convince the American people they're really going to do something about illegal immigration, whereas they have no intention of trying to stop it. We'll be right back in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel was just commenting that although they have president has signed the legislation, all the Republicans were there, many of them were there when the legislation was signed. Why, they're talking about building a fence, but there's nothing in the bill that says a defense. It specifies a fence as such. And here's Joel doesn't think they have any intention of building a fence, and I would agree with that. It is all pre-election and politicking, trying to give the American people the idea that the Republicans really are going to try to protect our nation and our national sovereignty, whereas, of course, many of them are committed to the destruction of our sovereignty and merging the United States and Mexico and Canada. That's what it's really all about. That's why they haven't tried to stop illegal immigration. But they can't tell the American people about that because most people are so immature and foolish. They honestly believe in sovereignty. They want to preserve our freedom and our Constitution. whereas that is not the agenda of the elite. Go ahead.
Our next topic is North Korea's coming nuclear test. Foreign Ministry of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea claimed this week that the DPRK was planning to conduct a nuclear test soon. This, of course, is a replay of the tactics used by Pyongyang in their test firing of several ballistic missiles. Predictably, the U.S. and Western allies reacted with dramatic protestations and condemnation of the old lying communist regime. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Chris Hill, who's in charge of the China desk, said, "We're not going to live with a nuclear North Korea. We're not going to accept it. It can have a future, or it can have these weapons. It cannot have both." I mean, that's a pretty strong threat, Dr. Stan. You know, you can, it's like Armitage threatening to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age, or bomb
Pakistan, right?
Stone Age. Of course, naturally, Hill refused to say what steps Washington actually might take to see that North Korea did not succeed in testing a weapon. This is because the United States actually will do nothing. I'll guarantee you that they'll do nothing. This is just talk. But why all the blustering response? I think it's quite simple. Just as the missile test highlighted North Korea's real-life threat to Western nations, so a nuclear test would prove to the world that the DPRK actually can build a nuclear weapon. It will no longer be a bluff. But it also highlights the hypocrisy of the U.S. position, threatening Iran with war for the mere hint of a nuclear program, while standing by and doing nothing while the North Koreans brandish about its growing arsenal of missiles and nuclear weapons. Why is Bush so eager to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age while insisting only on negotiations with North Korea? And I think the answer to that is because North Korea is perhaps the main trigger intended for World War III sometime. It's not scheduled to come until China and Russia are ready to launch their much-long-prepared preemptive nuclear strike against America, whereas Iran is the trigger for an upcoming Middle East war of regional proportions only. And that's what's on the schedule now, not North Korea, so we'll see no military action against North Korea despite these threats by the United States. They're only verbal threats. The continual intervention and antagonism by the U.S. in the Middle East is, in fact, a necessary prelude to starting World War III later on, and that's why I think the Iran war is a done deal. Now, I'm covering later on in the brief the actual naval preparations that are taking place in preparation for this war as we speak. Let me see if we can go to that.
I don't think the American people want a war with Iran. I don't think that the members of Congress or the Senate, the majority of them, certainly don't want a war with Iran. How can the president go ahead and on his own decide that we're going to have a war with Iran? Certainly, even the intelligence agencies, the CIA, says, you know, it's going to be 10 years before Iran will be able to build a nuclear weapon. So,
well,
you know,
it's much like the, you know, the North American Union that the Bush administration in Mexico and Canada are fully implementing as we speak without any law and legislation whatsoever. In other words, Congress is irrelevant. We have found by this legislation on the detainee bill that Congress has no courage to say no to this administration. It has no courage to stand up for their oath on the Constitution if they allowed this to happen. They had plenty of time to read 80 pages. It wasn't the 1,000 pages of the USA Patriot Act, which was passed without even passing out a bill for Congress to read. This is outrageous that they would allow a mere 80 pages to go past with this provision in here that's beyond the purview of the courts.
All right, fine.
There's the march to war in Iran coming, which we can cover at any time.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our special guest this evening is, of course, Joel Skousen. And I think it's so vitally important, ladies and gentlemen, to understand the implications of a war with Iran, because certainly what we'll do is inflame the entire Islamic world. I think it's going to inflame the entire world against the United States. And how many people are going to be killed over there? We've already killed certainly well over 100,000 in Iraq. By going in when there is no justification for going into Iraq. I mean, we had actually no weapons of mass destruction, at least none that threatened America. Well, Joel, you go right ahead and pick the story up from there.
Well, I have several sources, Dr. Stan, that now are starting to put dates on when the U.S. is planning to move against Iran, and they are saying somewhere around the New Year's or first part of January. There is definite buildup of naval ships and troops beyond the normal deployment to the Middle East, including mine layers and mine sweepers, which can only be needed if the target is Iran, concerning the Straits of Hormuz. David Lindorf reports that the newspaper, the magazine, The Nation, they've learned that the Bush administration and the Pentagon have moved up the deployment of a major strike carrier group of ships, including the nuclear aircraft carrier Eisenhower, as well as cruisers, destroyers, frigates, and submarine escorts and supply ships, all headed for the Persian Gulf just off Iran's western coast. Now, this information follows a report in the current issue of Time magazine that a group of ships capable of mining harbors has received orders to be ready to sail for the Persian Gulf by October 1st. Now, as Time writes in its cover story, "What Would War Look Like?" That was the name of the story. Evidence of the forward deployment of minesweepers and word that the Chief of Naval Operations had asked for a reworking of old plans for mining Iranian harbors suggested that a much discussed but until now largely theoretical prospect has become real. The U.S. is preparing internals for war with Iran. Part of the naval mobilization is aimed at Lebanon, but this in itself is also suspect. At least one Middle Eastern analyst is suspicious that the naval forces in Lebanon far exceed what is necessary for that area of conflict, where there really isn't any conflict right now at all. But there are tremendous naval resources there, down from NATO and the United States and Canada, that could play a major role in the U.S.-led war, which certainly, if it's a regional war, would involve naval bombardments of Lebanon and even on into Syria, with naval aircraft as well. So the militarization of the Eastern Mediterranean is broadly under the jurisdiction of NATO in liaison with Israel. And it's directed against Syria. It's conducted under the facade of a UN peacekeeping mission pursuant to a UN resolution. So in this context, some think that the war in Lebanon must be viewed as a stage in the broader conflict that the U.S. is building to take on Iran. And I think this is confirmed as well by the talks of Condoleezza Rice, who made a sudden trip to the Middle East, and Israeli sources have indicated that she's there coordinating the strike plans for Iran with Israel.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel commenting that Sydney has information that we're beginning to move minesweepers over and other naval forces up into the Persian Gulf area. Of course, the only reason for minesweepers is because we would be concerned about the Iranians mining the Straits of Hormuz, and we need the minesweepers to keep that area open because, of course, that's a choke point for oil coming from the Persian Gulf and could have a profound impact not only on the United States but upon nations throughout the world. And, of course, everything looks like the government, our own government, has decided to go to war. It doesn't matter the American people don't want a war with Iran. It doesn't matter that Congress and the Senate don't want a war with Iran. It doesn't matter. We have an imperial presidency, and they're going to go to war, but what will the implications of that war be as far as Iran's response? Do you really think they're just going to sit there and let us kill their people, or will they retaliate against our troops? You know, in Iraq, will they retaliate against our aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf? Well, what would happen if one of our aircraft carriers or two or three of them were sunk? I mean, what are the implications as far as America is concerned and the price of oil? And what are your thoughts?
Well, let's look at some of the strategic considerations the U.S. is facing when it decides to tackle Iran. You know, conflict against Iran and Syria would be unlike the previous conflicts with Iraq. It would be wider in scope. It would be deadlier. It would have active aerial and water naval fronts. In battle, sea power would be of much greater significance than in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Lebanon. The U.S. would really want a quick victory, but the chances of that happening are very, very slim. other than if they just want to bomb the heck out of things with a combination of missiles and aerial bombardment, which they could do fairly easily. But if they really want to shut down Iran, which has a much larger, more potent weapon, they're going to have to face some of the new weaponry that Iran has been accumulating over the past two decades.
My understanding is that Russia has been supplying them with some very sophisticated anti-aircraft or surface-to-air missiles that certainly could knock down some of our weapons that we'll be using against them.
That's right. There's also a whole host of anti-ship missiles that Iran has that would be very, very lethal. They've got high-speed torpedoes supplied by them with hyperspeed that put out a gas jet in front of the torpedo, which eliminates the water friction, and they can get, you know, four and five times the speed in a torpedo, making it very difficult to maneuver against. Anti-ship missiles that fly at near supersonic speeds that are very difficult to shoot down, even with our Gatling gun technology. So there's a great deal that we would face there. I think that with Iran's very powerful missile arsenal, both Israel and our American troop and bases in the Middle East would be at risk to retaliatory attacks from Iran. So this is not just going to be a one-person show. Iraq really didn't have any way to retaliate because we hit them from afar, but we're very close to Iran with our troop basing in Iraq, and I think we would see and take some casualties. Certainly Israel will also take some casualties if we take on this conflict.
And so one of the things that Iran would ordinarily would expect them to do would be to retaliate against Israel, who is our close ally over there. In fact, maybe our only ally over there, our only real ally.
Well, you know, there's even the Turkish card that the administration is playing. They've been wooing Turkey prior to this regional war. They made an oil deal with Turkey last month, suddenly turning on Iraq's northern pipeline and inexplicably, immediately shutting down any terrorist attacks on that same pipeline. That was a great evidence, in my opinion, that the U.S. actually had some control over terrorism in that region because the pipeline terrorist attacks stopped instantly when they started supplying oil to Turkey. Now, Debka.com in Israel claims that the CIA director, Porter Goss, made a deal with Turkey's premier to provide political and logistical support for U.S. airstrikes when they attack Iran. In exchange, Goss gave Turkey permission basically to take on the Kurds. They've wanted to be able to attack the bases of the PPK, the Kurdish Workers' Parties, in Iran and Iraq. Turkey sees the PPK as a separatist group responsible for terror attacks within Turkey. So Iran is not going to be a pushover. Their large contingent of short and medium-range missiles capable of reaching U.S. troop concentrations. Their submarine fleet of Russian manufacturing design is effective and quite silent. Would play havoc with many of our ships in the Straits of Hormuz if we get in that far. Of course, they have French, Russian, and Chinese anti-ship missiles, Silkworms and Sunburn missiles, which are very, very fast, top-of-the-line weapons. This could be a very bad war.
And, of course, an awful lot of Americans, an awful lot of Iranians could die in this, and maybe an awful lot of Israelis could die in this as well.
That's right.
But I don't think that anybody has stopped and thought of the considerations. And if the Iranians were to strike back, immediately you could hear the people in Washington, D.C. say, those treacherous Iranians, see, we told you you couldn't trust them. Look, they're fighting back. They've killed some Americans.
Yes, yes. So if they don't look bad now, they'll make them look bad and turn them into an enemy, just as we have done before in many other wars.
Well, I share your concern. I am very, very concerned about this, and I think every American should be, but it's amazing how blasé the American people are, as if you know, we can just go ahead and attack anybody we want to and never be worried about retaliation.
Well, we have an armchair mentality here in the United States of watching the evening news and seeing what explosions and attack the U.S. has been inflicting on other people. And there is a growing group of minority of Americans that are very dissatisfied with this president. But, of course, they would end up supporting the Democratic opposition, and they'll do the same thing if they get into power. I'm not sure how this is going to work out in 2008, but I think for sure the powers that be don't want a Hillary Clinton in because she's uncontrollable. They want puppets in as presidents who will take orders. Hillary is not the kind who will take orders. If she gets to be president, it's my opinion that she will attempt to run the country, and the powers that be will not tolerate that. So I'm not... I don't think that Hillary Clinton will win. I think the Republicans will run a stronger candidate, and despite the Bush administration unpopularity, I think, and that may be the reason why they will allow the Democrats to take control of Congress this month, why they perhaps engineered the Mark Foley scandal. The Democrats were the ones that released this information, and they probably had it months earlier and timed this release just prior to the election so as to have maximum impact. Certainly the Democrats are going to pick up Mark Foley's seat in Florida, and even Speaker Hastert is being criticized highly for being part of the cover-up of this scandal.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly share that that concern. Okay, what's next?
Well, going a little bit deeper into the Foley scandal, it's you know, I don't recommend that, you know, people read this, but I have read, you know, some of these emails, and they are so explicit. You know, a lot of people promote the concept of homosexuality being a rather alternative, benign lifestyle that doesn't hurt anybody but themselves. It's always portrayed in television. Almost every sitcom has to have some homosexual or gay couple doing something that appears normal and happy and go-lucky. But when you read these emails, these are filthy, Dr. Stan. These are just corrupt. When people see the kind of language that homosexuals use between each other, when they're out there trying to turn people on verbally, it's just disgusting. And, of course, this is pedophilia, too. Mark Foley pretended, of course, to be, you know, a conservative Christian with chairman of the Congressional Missing and Exploited Children's Caucus, sponsored legislation supposedly to crack down on the growing exploitation of minors, and then turns out to be a homosexual predator. Even though he's history, of course, he went out lying, of course, blaming his problem on alcoholism, checking himself into some secret location supposedly for alcoholic treatment, trying to basically pass off his moral problems as a medical condition. But it's clearly an immoral condition, not a medical condition. In any case, the problem that the Republicans are facing is that there is more and more information coming out now that people knew about this problem as far back as 10 years ago, Dr. Stan. Even 3 years ago, Kirk Fordham, Foley's former chief of staff, told the AP in an interview this week that he had informed Hastert's staff of Foley's predator habits more than 3 years ago. Hastert says he doesn't remember anything, but I'm afraid that information is going to come out linking Hastert to a cover-up. And, of course, I heard his reply on the news today talking about, we will vigorously investigate this, and I promise that we will get to the bottom of this, and I'm calling upon the FBI and everyone else, you know, have a vigorous investigation. Of course, he was always calling for reform as well. Well, we don't need any more reforms. That was the solution that they gave in the 9/11 Commission. We need some administrative reforms to keep this from happening. We need some heads to roll, Dr. Stan. I believe we need some people to resign who have been caught protecting these predators. I mean, this is a tremendous vulnerable field for young underage pages to come to work in the Congress of the United States and be subjected to entrapment and pedophilia and everything else from U.S. congressmen. You know, we had Barney Frank, we have Mark Foley, and I'm sad to say that when I was in Washington, D.C. as chairman of the Conservative National Committee, I was shocked, Dr. Stan, how many of our hardcore conservative leaders in Congress, House and Senate, were being unfaithful to their wives, had mistresses, or were homosexuals. And some prominent people I'm sure you're aware of, too, and I won't mention any names on the air, but I tell you, this is not a democratic problem. At least they don't make the same hypocritical pretensions to moral and principle that the Republicans do, who have some of these same problems.
Well, I think we live in certainly a nation that has lost its moral foundation, and you can't have a free society when you have an immoral people.
Yes, and you can't have a free society when Christians seem unable to perceive that they're being snookered by grand deception.
And I think when you have Christian leaders who tell us that, you know, you've got to vote for the Republicans because the Democrats are so bad, and I think they're all bad. I think they're all corrupt, and there are a few people who are of moral principles, but very, very few of them.
That's right. It's there's just too much deception, too much lying that's going on, Dr. Stan, and it's very, very disturbing. My next subject tonight is Bob Woodward's book, which implies more administration foreknowledge of 9/11. His book is called State of Denial. He claims in the book that CIA Director George Tenet had an emergency meeting with then-National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and several other people, warning of an imminent threat from Al-Qaeda. Now, the meeting took place in July of 2001. That was fully 2 months. It actually took place July 10th, 2 months and a day before the World Trade Center attack. Rice initially claimed no such meeting took place. Here's a quote. She said, "The idea that I would have ignored that, I find incomprehensible. I'm quite certain that it was not a meeting at which I was told there was an impending attack and refused to respond. But there were others present who do clearly remember the meeting, so Rice is having to backtrack."
And it's interesting that these people lie. Here's the Secretary of State lying to the American people, but she lied. It was time and time again before the 9/11 Commission, her famous statement right after 9/11. Who could ever imagine them hijacking planes and using them as weapons when there was report after report after report that described that? In fact, that very day, the military was having exercises where they were simulating planes being hijacked and crashed into buildings. How could she get away with these things? It almost as if, well, my goodness, if you don't go along with Condoleezza, you're racist. I believe this woman is somebody that is a perpetual prevaricator.
Well, it's interesting. One of the burning questions in newspapers, cable TV news, and blogs is why the 9/11 Commission report did not even mention this July 10th meeting. They had testimony by Condoleezza Rice. They had testimony by other participants, which include Richard Clark. He was a whistleblower supposedly against the Bush administration. He testified against them. He talked about the presidential briefing papers, and yet he was at this meeting, which was much more important and specific than the presidential briefing papers, and he never mentioned this in his testimony before the 9/11 Commission.
I think the whole thing is a cover-up. I think Richard Clark, you know, played his part very well before the 9/11 Commission. I think it's all showbiz, but I think that it's very, very obvious. If you read the latest book by Without Precedent by Foley and, pardon me, by Thomas Keene and by Lee Hamilton, they will tell you the on page 180, they will tell you that Condoleezza Rice said, you know, we were very concerned about Al-Qaeda, but the American people weren't ready to go to war. We needed a catalyzing event to get the American people behind us. And that's just what happened. We had a catalyzing event.
But, you know, there's something very interesting in my analysis about how much the dark side of government was involved in the planning and operation of this 9/11 attack. It seems obvious that those who sounded the warnings, like George Tenet, were not part of this particular conspiracy, while those like Rice and others high up in the FBI who blocked lower agents and blocked any of these warnings from getting into actual action must have known what was coming. But George Tenet, interestingly enough, is in the know about other dark side projects under his watch, both under Clinton and under Bush. He served under both administrations. The CIA trained Palestinian terrorists at the CIA, quote, farm in Virginia. What this tells me is that various government officials are sometimes only part way into dark side activities. They're excluded from others. It's a type of compartmentalization or cellular structure necessary to keeping the secrets of a conspiracy apart from too many people knowing them. You see what I'm saying? I'm saying George Tenet is in some ways a conspirator with the dark side, and yet he didn't know about this and was doing his duty in warning the NSA, and they had to cover up for the warning. Very interesting.
Well, I hope someday we learn what really happened. I think we can say is that there were people in government who knew it was going to happen that day and did nothing to stop it.
Well, I will go further because of what happens in the Trade Center with all the explosives inside. It had to be an inside job. So
right.
It wasn't just looking the other way. The terrorists could not have had access to shut down the building on weekends and other things and plant those explosives, which they did.
I'm sure they did. And I'm sure there were people at the highest echelons of our government who knew it was going to happen. And then they had to feign surprise. Mourn the 6,000 people who died and then the 5,000 and then 4,000 and then 3,000. They obviously intended or hoped or anticipated 5,000-6,000 Americans would die. Remember right after that?
Yes,
they kept
yes,
giving the wrong number. They kept giving
yes.
the wrong number. And the only reason there weren't 6,000 was because, of course, the fellow at Morgan Stanley, in charge of counterterrorism, got almost 2,500 people out.
Yes.
Well, Joel, let's go ahead and get your website. How can people get a copy of World Affairs Brief and let other people know about it?
Well, I encourage everyone to go to my website, worldaffairsbrief.com, where you can pick up all the daily news stories that scroll through the website during the day. There's lots to read in my archives. The World Affairs Brief itself comes out every Friday. It's my news analysis service like we're doing here. And it is with a modest subscription price. You can get a free sample by emailing me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. And, as we finish up this interview, I'd like to also state, this has been a very discouraging brief to write because it really is the beginning of the end, in my opinion. If the government passes something like this, which so easily forecloses one's ability to have our only major legal protection, which is to go before a judge, and even though some judges may be corrupt, they at least have to give the appearance that they're being fair. You sometimes have a chance to, if it's so outrageous, even conspiring judges can't, turn down a strong appeal knowing that it might be overturned by someone else. But now, nothing that happens under this bill, if you're taken into the system through a star change chamber proceeding, is ever going to come out with one's liberty again. So this is the beginning of the end, and I'm sad to say that, we have to begin to prepare as conservatives, as Christians and others to maneuver, almost underground, because you have to be able to escape this net once it starts closing. You can't be willing to allow yourself to be arrested and expect to hire a lawyer and get yourself out of jail. This is a matter of simply evading when government starts to arrest people, and we must be able to telegraph the information to one another and take appropriate action. That means developing a network in advance of people that you can trust and knowing who you can trust. And obviously, it means setting yourself right with the Lord so that you can merit some protection from God, because certainly he will allow good, righteous people, not all, but he will allow many as a remnant to survive this.
Amen to that. Well, I share your concern, Joel, and I certainly appreciate your commentary. I certainly read the World Affairs Brief on a every day, morning after I get through with my emails, why you're number one at the top of the list. Well, thank you so much for your commentary this week. And of course, we're just going to have to keep watching and praying. God bless.
All right.
Good night.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Joel was simply saying that this legislation is the beginning of the end of freedom in America, and the fact you're not hearing all of our leaders complain about it, the fact that they're planning on taking us into a war with Iran, that the fact that they have actually created new legislation for which there is no judicial appeal should concern every American. What are you doing about this? How are you helping us get the truth out? And I would suggest, if you do not take World Affairs Brief, that you go to joelskousen.com and get the email address and contact Joel and get a copy of his latest material. And, of course, we'll be covering that in our newsletters as well. It's vitally important that every American understand that when freedom fails, good men rot in filthy jails, and those who cry appease, appease are often hanged by those they hope to please. Freedom is something very, very precious. And there are people in the White House and the leaders of both political parties who are subservient to what I believe are truly demonic forces intent upon the destruction of what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. So right now, of course, we just want to remind our listeners, Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We want to remind our listeners that we are having an all-day conference here on the 29th of October of this month. 29th of October, we're bringing in Constance Cumby from Michigan. We're bringing Chris Pinto from Southern California. And actually, Constance is going to give two talks. Chris is going to give one long talk. I'm going to give a talk to several other people. It'll be a good day. We're serving lunch. We need to know how many are coming. I think this will be a very, very good conference. And certainly, we hope that you'll be able to come. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. I also think that you need to begin laying in a supply of health products, of vitamins, minerals, the other things that will keep your health up if there are food shortages. We do have a health catalog. We'll be glad to send you one free of charge and hope, of course, that you'll give serious consideration to getting the products that Barbara and I take that will allow us to keep our health up. And then, of course, we have a food catalog. It's simply the storage food, the things that you would need to look after yourself if there were a cutoff in the readily availability of food. And then we carry the Berkey products so that you will have water so you can filter your water. Not only, of course, today you want to get your pesticides and your fluoride out of it, but certainly if there were a serious problem in America, they would cut off the water supply, and then how would you get water from a stream? Well, would it be drinkable or potable? Well, with a Berkey water filter, of course, you can even get the sport bottles, contain maybe a pint or so, but you really need a big Berkey or one of the even larger Berkeys, or certainly the Berkey Light. So give us a call if you'd like more information on the Berkey water filters. If you'd like to get a free health catalog or a free food catalog, we'll be glad to send it to you and hope that you'll want to begin making preparations, because if we go to war with Iran, and I really think we are, everything points in that direction, it will change America forever. There will be retaliations on this country, and believe me, ladies and gentlemen, I'm old enough. I was stationed in Germany after the Second World War, before it was rebuilt. And I was stationed in Mainz, and behind those bright-sided storefronts, you look behind them, nothing but rubble, where once it stood a flourishing city. And the same thing was true with Frankfurt and so many of the other cities of Germany and of France. And believe me, if God is just, he is going to bring judgment on this country that has allowed almost 50 million of its unborn citizens to be killed before they could ever laugh or run or have an opportunity to be born. God will not be mocked indefinitely. And what's happening as far as homosexuality and these other things is, well, I'm sure is an affront to a holy God. America was once a Christian nation, but who would call it a Christian nation today? And look at our Christian leaders and what they're doing. Look at the man who was in charge in Congress of laws to protect abused children, Mr. Foley. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision protection, and we'll be back in just a moment. And remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But please hold your calls and don't call in unless we do ask for the calls, because we have with us on the line Mr. Steve Saylor. And Mr. Saylor is going to be talking to us about immigration, the unbridled immigration invasion of America that seems to be intent upon changing the very structure of our society, that converting us from what we were into a multicultural, multilingual society, and taking America from, you know, what a nation with the highest living standards, progressively down a slope and a race towards the bottom. Mr. Saylor, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Hi, Doctor. Good to be here.
Well, why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself, since we've never officially met?
Yes. My name is Steve. I write for a web magazine called VDARE. It's spelled V as in Victor, D-A-R-E.com. And I have a column every Monday morning in VDARE. So I've been writing about immigration now for about 6 years, and been following closely, you know, from the time back in 2000 when basically nobody wanted to talk about it till today, when it's the biggest issue in the country.
All right, fine. Well, of course, what is your impression of what's going on? How do you feel about the new legislation the president has just signed that is, of course, going to build a 700-mile wall and is going to solve the problem, so now we can, of course, face the issue of amnesty and we can give the people who are here amnesty?
Well, it's better than a sharp stick in the eye, which was what the Senate passed back in May, which was quite possibly the most disastrous bill ever passed by a legislative body in the United States history. But a 700-mile fence on a 1,950-mile border, there, you know, doesn't quite add up, but it's certainly better than the massive guest worker program that was not even a guest worker program, was a permanent worker program, better than pure amnesty and so forth. So, you know, the tide is moving politically in the right direction, but just about all of that's basically just what the American people want, what the special interests want, the media, all sorts of, you know, well-established groups within the United States want is the opposite. So it's still very much up in the air.
Well, it seems to me that if they really wanted to stop illegal immigration, they could have done it a long time ago. The laws are there. They were there in 1985 and 1995 right. And 1996, and they're there today. And all they have to do is enforce the laws, which they've steadfastly refused to do. I mean, they have a catch-and-release program. They catch them, and then they release them. They refuse to take action against, the vast bulk of the employers who are employing people who are here illegally and know that. The IRS knows where these people are working because many of them have phony IRS cards, Social Security cards, and of course the Social Security Administration knows exactly where they are. The bureaucracy of government knows, and they're refusing to enforce our laws. We have to ask ourselves, why won't they enforce the laws? Do you have any idea?
Absolutely. It's corruption. I mean, in 1986, Congress passed and President Reagan signed a compromise a comprehensive reform that sounded pretty reasonable. You know, I mean, I was young and naive then, and I thought it sounded like a good idea at the time.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Mr. Steve Saylor. Well, This is Dr. Stan, I guess, is Steve Saylor. And, Steve, you were saying in 1986, why, they told us there were a million illegal immigrants in this country. They were going to give one amnesty. It would never happen again. There were only a million people here. We could absorb those people. And then they passed all these pieces of legislation that,
yeah,
you know, said that, you know, you could take action against the people who were hiring these people illegally. And we were going to enforce our border laws. And we were going to stop the people from coming into the country. And the only thing we did was, of course, give, amnesty not to 1 million, but to almost 3 million. I think it was 2.7 million people.
Exactly.
And then, of course, they refused to enforce the laws. Now, that was the Reagan administration. That was the first Bush administration. That was the Clinton administration. And now, at least 5 years of this present Bush administration, they've steadfastly refused to enforce the laws. Isn't that criminal activity on the part of successive administrations?
Yes, and Congress has been in on it, too. What happens is, if when the Immigration Naturalization Service back in the old days would show up at an employer and start rounding up people who were illegal aliens, the employer would call up his congressman or senator and go, you know, all that money I gave you, well, you're not going to see it again in the next election unless you call off the INS. It's just simple, outright corruption, but the press was never very interested in following up on this story. So that's what happened the last time. Starting this time with a fence makes all the sense in the world. You need multiple defenses, and a fence is a very good idea. All over the world, different countries are putting up fences right now, and they can be made pretty successful if they do them right.
But if you only authorize a 700-mile fence for a 2,000-mile border, now, I may not be very smart, but it seems to me if I was trying to get into the country, I would simply go around the fence.
Right. I mean, what's going to happen next is if they do build this fence, and first of all, they've only authorized a fraction of the money. It's this isn't going to be hugely expensive for a country like the United States. But so far they've only authorized like $1.2 billion, and they're going to need a few billion more. Then they're going to need some rules they have to override some environmental lawsuits and things like that. But if they do get this fence built from California through Arizona, what it's going to do is it's going to shove illegal immigration out into New Mexico. Just as when they built fences in San Diego used to be just overrun with illegal aliens. They put up a short fence. And that drove illegal aliens out into Arizona. So the crisis has mostly been in Arizona lately. It shows kind of the lack of seriousness that...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. Saylor. We were pointing out, of course, that we have authorized the building of a fence. And Mr. Saylor points out, yes, but the money that they authorized isn't enough to build the fence. So they've authorized enough money to at least get started on building a 700-mile fence along a 2,000-mile border. And, of course, some people might say, well, if you got a 2,000-mile border, why don't you build a 2,000-mile fence? But obviously, people who come up with that really are rather simplistic. They probably believe there's a conspiracy or something, or they're really not very realistic. I mean, the 700-mile fence is such a great thing for a 2,000-mile border. But then Mr. Saylor pointed out there isn't enough money. There certainly will be, environmental lawsuits against doing this. Certainly the Mexicans don't want this. In fact, the Mexican leaders smile and say, well, we know that the fence is never going to be built. Do you think they know something that the average American doesn't know?
Well, certainly they talked to the Bush administration, and the Bush administration has treated Mexico with kid gloves, hardly begins to say it. It's kind of like the way the Clinton administration treated Yeltsin's regime in Russia. There's been a long, long family history with the Bush dynasty going back to 1960 of relationships with important power brokers within Mexico. It's never really been followed up in the press. Most of what I've learned about it comes from a small Mexican-American journal in California called El Andar that's pointed out some really obvious things that nobody else seems to be interested in. But, going back to 1960, George Bush the Elder,
he needed a Mexican partner so he could do offshore oil drilling in Mexico, and that's against Mexican law. So he signed up a guy named Jorge Diaz Serrano, who eventually became head of Pemex, the Mexican oil monopoly, and was so crooked in that job that, you know, even by Mexican standards, he ended up in prison for 5 years. There were very good relationships between the Bush family and the Salinas family that was ran Mexico from 88 through 94. And Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, used to vacation several times down at the ranch of Raul Salinas, who was known as Mr. 10%. He was the president's brother, and he took 10% of every government contract. And he eventually ended up in prison on murder charges, and his wife was arrested in Switzerland for trying to take $94 million out of a safe deposit box. These are the kind of friends that the Bush dynasty has had in Mexico. And when they look at when you and I look at Mexico, you go, oh, it's kind of a nice place to visit, except for all those guys with guns walking around. But, God, you know, it's not a great place for the average Mexican. But for rich people in Mexico, it's great. They love it. You never see rich people come to the Mexicans migrate to the United States.
Well, that's because, of course, you have many multi-billionaires down there, and you have a lot of millionaires, and then you have a very powerful but corrupt police and a powerful but corrupt military who kill people and seem to get away with it. And then you've got, of course, the drug running, and then you've got a small bureaucracy, and then you've got a great many peasants or people who just are downright poor and have no opportunity of ever improving themselves. And these are the people who come to America looking for a better life.
I mean, what Mexico needs several things, but basically the same people have been running Mexico, various families, for hundreds of years. Occasionally there's a revolution and some generals get accepted into the upper class and marry into it, but it tends to be the same people, and one hand washes the other. I mean, Mexico just has a tremendous number of billionaires for a country that has so many poor people. They basically can't collect taxes that are legally owed by the rich. The rich just will not pay the taxes that are due. So there isn't enough money for schools, so the Mexican people aren't well enough educated to make something of themselves. And the police aren't paid enough to be honest, so they're all out being crooked. And just one thing builds on top of the other, but basically corruption is the problem in Mexico, but the United States has never felt like addressing that issue or putting any pressure on Mexico to overcome that problem. Instead, we let the Mexican upper class use the border as a safety valve to bleed off discontent off into the United States.
And, of course, the great tragedy is it's a tragedy for the Mexican people, but it's even going to be a greater tragedy for America, because you go into a city like Los Angeles, Los Angeles is no longer an American city. The majority of the people there are foreign-born, and not all Mexicans. Sometimes they're Vietnamese or Chinese. Tremendous numbers of Chinese are being smuggled into our country now on a regular basis. But it's all part of our government's plan to move us from being an American country into a multilingual, multicultural society, because I believe we have people in government who have a different loyalty. And their loyalty is not to America, but to this sort of globalist dream. Have you ever run into this concept?
Well, I certainly see it. Like I was reading the Council of Foreign Relations report on building a North American community of Canada, United States, and Mexico, and it's kind of the usual suspects of very prominent wealthy people of, you know, from all three countries, whether representing La Raza in the United States or Clinton's immigration boss, Doris Meisner, the kind of Mexican power brokers that you see. And once they get together in a meeting in a room, the interests of the people that they're supposed to be representing just disappear. And for this kind of globalist elite that they each represent, they start making recommendations for what would be in their interest, which just basically is not those of the people of the three countries. And you see it over and over again, this kind of this kind of globalist class of Davos man, you know, named after the city in Switzerland where they meet every year.
And what you're really suggesting is that there's sort of an elite who run things, and then there's this common people out here that believe in America, but they seem to have a different allegiance, a different calling. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. You don't see people, you know, I mean, if you look at Bush's strategy, the grand strategy, it just makes no sense. I mean, what do we have? We have a strategy of invade the world, invite the world, and then in-hawk to the world.
I like that. I invade the world, you know, invite the world, and in-hawk to the world. And certainly we seem to be intent upon going to war now with the rest of the Muslim world. Iran, maybe Syria, maybe Saudi Arabia, and who knows what else we'll get into invading. And then we're inviting the whole world to come here. And it's sometimes
Just recently, if I jump in, the president worked out a deal with the king of Saudi Arabia to bring 15,000 more young Saudi college students to America, young men, to come study in American colleges. You know, and this was announced almost 5 years to the day after the day that 15 young Saudi men and four other Middle Easterners, you know, killed 3,000 Americans.
Yeah.
Now, is this really wise?
I understood we were going to subsidize that. Was that accurate, or did I get that wrong? We were going to help finance
it. It could well be. It could well be that we're subsidizing them, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, I think that, you know, certainly, do we want an America, you know, a strong America? Or do we want a multicultural society? Do we want a nation where English is the official language of the nation? Or do we want to be a multilingual society? And I don't think most Americans, I think even many of those of Spanish descent, do not want to see us a multilingual society. But it would appear that there people within the executive branch of government, and even many of those within the legislative branch of government, seem to have a different loyalty. So what can we do?
Well, basically, you have to hold the political candidate's feet to the fire. We've seen a certain improvement over the last year among members of the House of Representatives. The Senate, all the way through the spring, seemed to feel like it wasn't necessary that they answer to the American public. I think they're starting to get the message now. If you look at the likely presidential candidates in 2008, you're not looking at people who put the welfare of American citizens first on this immigration issue at all. I mean, you've got John McCain, who, with Ted Kennedy, sponsored the original Senate bill. You've got Chuck Hagel, senator from Nebraska, who then sponsored the final bill with Mel Martinez. You've got Rudy Giuliani, who has always been very pro-illegal immigration. I don't know if George Allen's going to make it to the race. He at least voted against it. Mitt Romney up in Massachusetts hasn't declared much on this topic. He has some potential. But, you know, it's not an impressive field.
I agree with you totally, and I really believe that we have very real problems in America because we have no effective leadership. We have a lot of people who are put forward by the establishment. The media, really, if they don't want you to be mentioned as a candidate for president, you will never be mentioned. Nobody's even going to know you're running. And that's, of course, how they control. What happens, and we they don't go to the polls and vote for the candidate of our choice, I believe we go to the polls and vote for the candidates of their choice. And we've seen time and time again where they've taken obscure people like a peanut farmer from Georgia named Jimmy Carter that nobody had ever heard of, and they made him the President of the United States in 1976. And they seem to be very, very good at this over and over again. And obscured.
Yeah, so they're very good at keeping other people out of consideration. That, I mean, you'll notice if you read, you know, the New York Times, whenever the politics of immigration comes up, the word is always used in the headline in one form or another is angry. Anybody who wants to see our laws against illegal immigration enforced is denounced as angry.
Either that or racist. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Steve Saylor. right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Steve, we were simply talking about the fact that certainly a lot of the politicians right now seem to be very much in favor of stopping illegal immigration. But I have a feeling that this is simply pandering to the public. You know, and as soon as the elections are over and they're reelected, then they're going to go back to certainly promoting illegal immigration for another 2 years until the election comes up in 2008, and then they'll suddenly begin pandering to the public again. What are your thoughts?
It's quite possible. I mean, what we need is the public to stay active, to stay interested, to stay focused on this issue. It is probably the single most important long-term issue for the United States. Who gets to be an American? Who gets to be your neighbor? Is just a crucial question. I mean, nobody thinks about this in the press in all serious fashion. I mean, one of the questions I like to ask people is, how many people in the world live in countries where the average income is lower than Mexico's? Not lower than the United States, but lower than Mexico. And the answer is 5 billion. Just 5.04 billion people live in countries that are poorer on average than Mexico. So the question is, it's not just keeping out Mexicans that's the crucial question. There's an entire world out there of people who would like to come to the United States. We're now up to 300 million people in the United States. But there's 5 billion people out there in the rest of the world that are poorer than the average Mexican. So when Congress starts talking about guest worker programs that, as it turns out, aren't even guest worker programs, because if you read the fine print, everybody who gets in can then immediately apply for permanent residency. It's not just the 107 million people in Mexico, which, according to a Pew Hispanic Center poll, over 40% of them would like to move to the United States if they could. It's this 5 billion poor people from around the world. If they put through a guest worker plan like they're always talking about, in fact, it's not going to be Mexicans that the employers are going to hire. It's typically going to be Southeast Asians and South Asians, you know, places like Bangladesh and China, Thailand, and Indonesia. Places we haven't even really, Americans haven't even really thought about. And then what Mexicans will then be encouraged to continue to illegally immigrate to the U.S.
So, but of course, Steve, if you were living in Bangladesh or you were living in India or you were living in China, wouldn't you want to come to America and have the benefits that we have here?
Sure, absolutely. But here's the thing. It just doesn't do much good for these countries. I mean, Mexico has continued to be a corrupt country that just does not economically get its act together because there just isn't much pressure at home. I mean, in my lifetime, there's been two great reforms around the world that have done a lot of good for hundreds of millions of people. One was when the Chinese decided that communism was stupid, and they started reforming their system and making more of a free market at home. And that's increased the prosperity of hundreds of millions of Chinese tremendously. The other was when the Indians finally went broke about 1991 under socialism, and they started dumping socialism over the last 15 years. And that has done a lot of people good too. These countries have to fix themselves.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Steve Saylor, and as we talk about what's really going on from the immigration point of view and what we can do about it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Steve Saylor. We're talking about the immigration problem, and certainly, Steve, would you like to get the website out for your group? And of course, is there a telephone number? Would you like to put it? Tell us anything about the VDARE organization you work for.
Well, it's a web magazine, and it was founded by Peter Brimelow, prominent journalist over the years with Forbes and National Review and CBS Marketline. He wrote a book in the 90s, 1995, called Alien Nation, that was probably still remains about the best general purpose introduction to the immigration question, although, you know, Pat Buchanan's got an excellent book out now, Tom Tancredo, and there's finally a lot more interest in it today. Anyway, we have a magazine on the web at VDARE.com. Peter Brimo himself is an immigrant from England, so he named it after the first English baby born in America, Virginia Dare. So that's where the kind of odd name comes from. But you know, we have new article up every day, plus a blog, and you can find it all at VDARE.com. And I think it's really one of the best sites for, you know, hard-hitting facts and commentary on the immigration question.
Now, who's really funding this whole movement towards illegal immigration? Because it takes a lot of money to do what they're doing, to put together these organizations like La Raza and Mal Dave and Metcha and, of course, the others, and to be able to put a half a million people on the streets of Los Angeles and Chicago. It takes a lot of money to get something like that going. I mean,
where does
you're
the
trying
money
to get
from?
Couple hundred people out for a meeting. It's a momentous task, but they were able to get a half a million people out. Who's putting up the money?
Well, let's see. La Raza, the National Council of Raza, which stands for the race, which is meaning the Mexican race. Who is it funded by? The Rockefeller Foundation? The federal government puts a lot of money into it as well. Basically, the most respectable members of the establishment.
How about the Ford Foundation?
Yeah, Ford Foundation. Excuse me, not Rockefeller. I'm sorry. Rockefeller actually does mostly good work with medicine. The Ford Foundation. I'm sorry. Very funny example of John O'Sullivan's rule, which is that any organization that's not overtly conservative will be taken over and moved to the left by its staff over time. Certainly Henry Ford would not, probably wouldn't approve of what the Ford Foundation's up to these days.
Well, we'll never know. But under any circumstances, the Ford Foundation really started La Raza back in 1968, along with either Mal Dave or Metcha, I can't remember
yes.
which one, but they have been funding this all along, and of course, even the government funds it. In fact, the government funds a racist organization, La Raza. What's the meaning of La Raza? The race.
It means the race. It comes from... Basically, it's kind of an interesting story behind it. It's basically the Mexican government came up with the concept that the mestizo mixed European and Indian was kind of the perfect combination of the people of the world, and thus that Mexican mestizos were the cosmic race, as the term was brought forward in the 1920s through the 1940s. So the term La Raza or La Raza Cosmica, the cosmic race, is used in the Mexican government. Of course, it turns out the Mexican government is still basically run by people who are pretty much all white, which is kind of, I mean, if you look at, like, President Fox, the outgoing president, his grandfather was an Irish-American born in Cincinnati. He's about 6.5 feet tall. So there's a lot of... all of Mexico, you have this kind of bizarre situation that's not discussed here in the United States much, where basically the descendants of the conquistadors who conquered the place 500 years ago still pretty much own Mexico, but they spend a lot of effort to promote the idea that... we're really all unified here, and sure, it might look like a bunch of tall white people actually are the rich people in Mexico, but that's not really, you know, you have to look past all that.
Well, I think, of course, that you have a ruling elite in Mexico. I think you have a ruling elite in the United States. That's the tragedy, and most people really don't understand that, and they go to the polls every 4 years and vote for the candidates, not of their choice, but of the elite's choice, and they give us a choice between John Kerry, Senator John Kerry, and George W.
Yeah,
Bush.
Both members of the Skull and Bone Society at Yale. I think it was pretty funny.
I don't think it was funny. I think that where was the outcry from the American people? I mean, you only have about 15 people a year that join this, and they only could find two members of the Skull and Bones to run for president. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Steve Saylor. We're talking about the immigration problem. We're talking about the fact that this is being pushed for entirely different reasons than the average American thinks, that the politicians claim they're very concerned, but the vast majority of them are not. The vast majority of them are encouraging illegal immigration because illegal immigration is going to change the basically the demographics of our country. It's going to change the culture of our society because there are people who do not believe, at least this is my opinion, in America. And they want to do something that Steve had referred to. You know, they want to build a North American community. In fact, there's a book that was published by the Council on Foreign Relations calling Building a North American Community. What is all about? Does this have anything to do with the fact that the elite don't want to control illegal immigration?
Well, illegal immigration was not a major concern in the report by the members of the Council of Foreign Relations. It's something that they can kind of bring up and wave their hands at, but they don't have much interest in it.
But I think that they really do want to build a North American community and merge our society with Mexico and Canada. Isn't that really what building a North American community is all about?
Yeah, they talked about a lot about labor mobility. You know, watch out, you know, we need more labor mobility within North America. Well, you know, we have an awful lot right now. We have some number of illegal immigrants that nobody knows exactly. It's probably 15 to 20 million range, something like that right now. We're just starting to try to take some steps to cut down on that.
But are we really trying to do anything, or is it all just showbiz?
This fence actually has some potential. I've been to the border in Arizona along NACO, and currently we have a fence. It's about 3.5 feet high. It's six strings of barbed wire, and about every 100 yards along the fence, somebody has come along and either bashed it down or they've dug underneath it. And you can see, you know, a trail of footprints and all sorts of garbage that's been dropped by the hundreds of illegal aliens who flow through these trails every 100 yards along the fence every night. Building a real fence actually does cut down, but what it does is it pushes people out around the edges of it. If they do get this done in any kind of reasonable amount of time, it will have some impact, but... It has to be finished.
All right, we'll be back. Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Steve Saylor. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'll be glad to take your calls. I read about 10 days ago that Congress had really done something about this immigration problem. They were going to get really tough on this. They passed a law saying it is now illegal to build a tunnel underneath, of course, the border. Number one. Second, they can now deport members of illegal and violent gangs who are in this country illegally. In other words, if they're in this country illegally and they're a member of a violent gang, they can be deported. And I forgot what the third thing was. It was almost that significant. And as I read that, and the congressmen were slapping one another on the back saying, we're really got to get tough on immigration. And I thought, does anybody in the public really believe that they're serious?
I mean, there has been some progress. I mean, Congressman Tom Tancredo's immigration caucus, was up to, I don't know, about 100 members now from very few at the beginning of the decade. But it is so easy to get people distracted, get their eye off the ball on this issue. People don't think seriously about it. What we need are institutions, we need organizations, we may need a new political party at some point. 2008 will probably tell whether the Republican Party will turn out to represent the American public on this issue, or whether it's just going to be Tweedledee and Tweedledum. The Democrats you know, for their own self-interest, always want more immigration because it always turns out to be more Democratic voters in the long run. That's what Senator Kennedy has been doing all the way back to 1965. You know, the Senate bill that he sponsored with John McCain that turned into the one that passed the Senate, that's the third bill for to increase immigration he's been involved in his career. And it's always been to get more Democrats into the country. It makes a lot of sense. Now, why the Bush administration thinks that this is great for Republicans, that's a complicated question.
Well, you know, of course, Ted Kennedy had a legislation he tried to get through for years. It was called No Child Left Behind, and he couldn't get that legislation through, but George Bush got it through. Ted Kennedy had legislation for a Medicare drug bill, and he couldn't get it through, but George Bush got it through. And for our listeners out there who'd like to check this out, it's up on the net. In the year 2003, the Bush Foundation, headed by George Herbert Walker Bush and George Bush and Jeb Bush, gave the Man of the Year award to none other than that great American patriot, Ted Kennedy. So you have to wonder, is there really any sort of a difference between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, other than the people who believe there's a difference are really Tweedledum?
It's been a very good decade for Senator Kennedy.
Sure has.
And it's what happens is, you know, why so many Republican politicians have been in favor of more illegal immigration is a good question. Some of it is just pure corruption. It's just payoffs from big growers who want more peasants to pick their crops. In terms of President Bush, I don't know. I mean, best guess I've ever come up with is that he's kind of thinking dynastically, and the most likely president from the next generation of the Bush family is his brother Jeb's son, George P. Bush, whose mother is Mexican, and George P. speaks Spanish, and he's a very handsome guy, and he loves getting out there and campaigning. And that it looks, as far as I can tell, it looks like the president is trying to, in order to elect another Bush in another generation, he wants the government to elect a new people. And that's what he's trying to do, is bring a whole lot of Mexicans in the country to vote for his nephew. It seems kind of nuts, but there's been a lot of other things he's done that don't really make any sense except within family, you know, within the weird logic of the Bush family.
All right. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and our guest is Steve Saylor, and he's suggesting that the reason that the Bushes are doing what they're doing is because they want a Bush dynasty, and they would like to get, of course, I guess it would be George's nephew to run. So that certainly is a theory I haven't heard before. It's certainly very interesting. But my concern is we don't have time. I mean, we here in California, where I live, we have a budget, a state budget, a little over $100 billion. Over $10 billion of that is going to fund the illegal immigrants here, who are simply, crowding our emergency rooms. You go to an emergency room at a hospital now, it may take 3, 4, 5, 10 hours to get seen by a doctor. I mean, or they're bringing in illegal immigrants, they're bringing in new diseases, and the diseases we've never even heard of before, like Chagas disease, and now we have leprosy back again, and drug-resistant tuberculosis, and certainly, 80% or 90% of the children born at the Los Angeles County Hospital are born to illegal immigrants, and I mean, the crime is just out of all proportion. There are more and more Mexican gangs and Mexican violence. Of course, it's usually, you know, a Mexican on Mexican, but then we have our Mexican sexual predators, and if they can get back to Mexico, they don't even bother to send them back here to face trial for murder or rape or whatever it else it would be, and certainly they're destroying our educational system. We cannot afford this if we are going to maintain our status as a first world nation.
Yeah, what illegal immigration does is it's a way to shift costs onto the general public and on the general taxpayer. Especially if you're an employer, you can hire somebody for minimum wage or just a little bit over it. But with and not pay their health insurance benefits, not pay all these other things. But then what it turns out is that, you know, America, we Americans, we're civilized people, and we're not going to let people within that are living in the United States live that way on what they actually earn. So we will educate their children for them. When they get sick, they will go to the emergency room and have extremely expensive care at the hospital. We will provide them with policing. We'll, you know, we'll put their lawbreakers in jail. We will do all of these things. And the costs are being shifted away from the employers, the cost of labor, onto the general public. You know, I think it's a general trend all throughout our time right now, this era, to shift costs. You know, the clever people are dumping the full cost of whatever they want to do onto the public. And the rest of us, you know, we don't read the fine print, so we don't figure that out. We just see that things keep getting more and more expensive. But I think what the rest of the country is waking up to the problem of what's happened here in California. I mean, California used to be kind of the promised land of the average American. Regular guy could go out to California. The housing was reasonable. Wages were good. It was, you know, life was good. But life remains extremely good for the wealthy in California. But basically, they're driving out the whole middle class out of California because the cost of living has gone through the roof, whether it's through taxes or through the enormous cost of housing, the cost of private schooling or moving out to an exclusive school district is just crushing the people in California. So the cost of living in California is running about 50% higher than the rest of the country right now. So, you know, for people in Hollywood, for the rich in general, yeah, you know, life's still pretty good in California. But you're just turning it into more of a Latin American-type society with the rich and the poor and not many people in between. That's not the American way.
We're seeing more and more, of course, the gated, guarded communities for the rich, you know, around the periphery of the cities, and then in the inner cities, sort of a jungle.
Yeah, it's just not the kind of America that, you know, that Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin looked forward to. I mean, Ben Franklin actually explained everything back in 1751. He pointed out that in America there was a lot of land and not many people, and that meant that wages were high and land prices were low, which meant that an awful lot of very high percentage of people could afford to make enough money to buy some land, to get married, to have children, the whole American dream. And he laid it all out in 1751, Ben Franklin, and it still makes sense. I mean, what you're seeing in California today, for example, is seeing people born here can't get married until they're, like, approaching 40. All sorts of people that I went to high school with finally got married for the first time after the age of 40 because they could finally afford to buy a house. Now, that's, you know, is that really, you know, how we as Americans want to live? And the question is, no, not really. But the rest of the country has to worry about this. Are we pushing the rest of the country in this direction? Because, like, what we're seeing now with the latest census that came out for the 2005 year, was that California, the immigrant population is no longer flocking to California. They're moving out of California to the rest of the country. They're spreading out because they've kind of had their way with California, and it's gotten so expensive, and wages relative to the cost of living are so low in California that they're moving out to the rest of the country.
Are you speaking of immigrants, or are you speaking of just Americans?
Actually, both are, but you know what we're. But then, as California people native to California flee to other states, they're finding out that all the problems are going with them, because the illegal immigrants are also moving to Nevada and to Utah and to Texas and to Kentucky even now. There was a great article in the L.A. Times recently about a illegal alien woman in Los Angeles who. She had three daughters, but her husband had never had a son by any of the three women that he had children with. So So she started taking fertility pills, and then she had triplets, but the son was born with a birth defect, so I guess she kept them up. And then she had quadruplets, so now they have 10 children, and they finally... But it turned out that all of her 9 siblings that had also snuck in illegally from Mexico, they'd all gotten out of Los Angeles. They'd moved to Lexington, Kentucky. And they said, boy, you know, Los Angeles is just like Mexico. You know, there's so many Mexicans there, and the wages are low, houses are expensive, the schools, nobody speaks English. So we all moved to Lexington, Kentucky. It's like we're back in America now. So, but how much longer for Lexington, Kentucky?
And, of course, the thing is that if she has 9 children, all of them become eligible for welfare. Isn't that nice? I mean, where else in the world can you come in illegally and then get welfare for your children and free medical care for your children and free education for your children? And even subsidized housing, isn't America wonderful? But how long can it last? Or is this part of an organized plan to destroy our country by people of great wealth who have a different agenda? I just asked that question. Because what's going on, if you look at it logically, just doesn't make sense.
It makes sense for various interest groups. If you're Senator Kennedy, you know, his original plan was to bring in more Irishmen to vote for Kennedy's, and then the Irish stopped coming. Actually, the Irish managed to fix up their own country, and Ireland's quite prosperous now. But he quickly found out that everybody else, that other immigrants, tended to vote Democratic. If you're running some kinds of businesses, it helps. But does it really help the business? I mean, people always get to go, well, it's good for the economy to have all this peasant labor. Not really. What's good is to have productive workers, and we keep bringing in people with extremely low levels of education from south of the border, and their children don't really catch up. And it, you know, if you look out 4 generations, there's still a huge gap between Hispanics and the rest of the U.S. in education level in terms of dropout rate from high school and so forth. Various interest groups can make a lot of money or get a lot of political power in the short run. If you are running an ethnic activist group like La Raza, or you are a Hispanic political consultant on how to get the Hispanic vote, all this stuff, you know, it's all in your self-interest in the short run. Is it good for the rest of the country? You know, it's a lot like, I think the answer is a lot like that those Mexicans who moved to Lexington, Kentucky said, you know, hey, we're trying to get away from Mexico, and it came with us to Southern California. Now we've moved to Kentucky. It's just going to keep coming with them. You know, the disorder, the corruption, and the just general expensiveness and turning this into a society of the rich and the poor instead of a middle-class society like America was supposed to be.
And I think that's exactly what's happening. We're moving towards a two-tiered society. The very rich, then, of course, you'll have the military, you'll have the police who will keep the rest of us in order, you'll have the bureaucracy, and then you'll have a vast number of impoverished people. That just seems to be the way we're going. And maybe there are some people who like that sort of society.
Latin America has been like that for 500 years. It can be fairly stable. I mean, you'll have a revolution every now and then. And, you know, I mean, what you also see is then you'll have, like, you know, these leftist, you know, representatives like Hugo Chavez and so forth of the oppressed Indians and blacks will rise up and usually end up destroying the economy with kind of dumb leftist ideas. But you got to understand where they're coming from. And we'll probably end up with something like that in the United States as well after time. And, you know, the rich will start wondering why they invited all these poor people in. But, you know, generally in Latin America, you have these uprisings, but then things calm down and the rich end up running things again. Nothing ever happens much good in Latin America, but it's probably where we're headed in the United States.
Well, why is there anything we can do to stop it?
Basically, we've got to drive this up as the most important long-term issue, that we can't let people We can't let people sniff and say, "Oh, you're just so, you know, you sound so angry about immigration. You know, this is important." We can't have people just continuing to say that they're not going to pay attention to it, that they're superior enough, that they're wealthy enough, that they don't have to worry about competition from illegal immigrants and so forth. Their kids don't have to worry about it. We've got to look out for what's in the best interest of all American citizens.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I certainly will just have about three more minutes here while we have run a few ads, and then we'll let you go. But I think it's so vitally important that people understand that we are losing America. We're losing America because we have leaders who refuse to enforce our laws. And, of course, if you refuse to enforce the law and you are in a position of authority, then I believe you're not only a lawbreaker, I believe you're a traitor to America. Well, Steve, why don't you go ahead and finish up the program here? You've got 3 minutes to wrap up your thoughts for the evening, and then we'll let you go.
Hey, Dr. Stan, I really appreciate it. Anyway, I just wanted to say once again, my name is Steve Saylor. I'm with VDare.com. I think your readers will find it's a very lively, interesting website, and that will give you the straight story. I think what we've got to do is you can't let people get away with using their opinion on immigration, that they're just going to ignore illegal immigration, as a status marker, that their job is, you know, is elite enough that nobody from Chiapas is going to come and drive down their wages, that their kids are always going to get into the ultra-elite magnet programs and the top private schools, and they don't have to worry about what the effect of illegal immigration is on the public schools.
What do
you have
about,
to call people on that.
What do you think about the security and prosperity partnership that has been advocated? What do you think about the American or transnational highway?
What this highway is, you know, we import an enormous amount of stuff from China to sell in Walmart. But it drives certain people crazy that it still has to go through American ports on the West Coast, which are typically unionized and have pretty high wages. So the idea is to divert the enormous number of freighters bringing stuff from China to the United States down to Manzanillo and Lazaro Cardenas, these small ports on the coast of Mexico, and then build a high-speed. And then to get all the stuff to the Walmarts all across the country, you won't have to pay American truck drivers. You can pay Mexican truck drivers, and they'll be able to just zoom right across. Who knows what else they'll be taking? I'm sure they'll be taking along drugs and illegal immigrants and everything else. But there's money to be made from all this.
Do you think there's a program to destroy American sovereignty?
There is a tendency. There is a whole lot of incentives that say, in the short run, my group, my company, my lobby can make a lot of money on this. In the long run, it's not really going to benefit anybody.
Well, those who want to destroy sovereignty, won't it benefit them?
I think in the long run, if you end up turning this country into Venezuela,
hold that thought there.
Mexico.
Hold that thought. Well, I simply was asking Mr. Saylor if he thought that there was a move to destroy our sovereignty, and that the people who really had a different worldview would benefit. And you just give a response, and then I'll let you go.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people who think American sovereignty is out of date. They will probably live to regret ever all the actions they've taken to make it out of date. When America looks like Venezuela, they're not going to like what they've done. But it's possible. There's not that many of them. And it's possible that if the American public pays attention to this issue, that we can stop them.
All right, well, I certainly hope you're right. Steve, thank you so very much for being
with us.
All right,
thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure. Good night. All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Sydney. We hope that many of you want to get some of the material we have. We have a great four-tape set on illegal immigration. We have a book called The Minutemen by Jerome Corsi that goes into the fact that there really is an effort to destroy our sovereignty. And, of course, the people who are pushing the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the transnational highway, hate America because they have a different worldview. They worship a different God. We have the video entitled The Conquest of Aslan, put out by Glenn Spencer. We carry a book called Fighting Immigration Invasion. But how do you put it all together? Let me suggest a book that's 50 years old. Actually, it was published 48 years ago. It was called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. It's the story of the only investigation that has ever been allowed of the great tax-exempt foundations, specifically Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford. You will find out that these organizations have been financing communism and socialism and humanism and moral depravity. They financed, of course, the Kinsey Report aimed at changing the sexual mores of our society. There really are people who have a different worldview. You'll certainly want to get some of our newsletters. Let me suggest my last newsletter, and I believe it was either my June or July newsletter. Go up on the Internet and look at RadioLiberty.com, look at my newsletter on immigration. Maybe it was the May newsletter. They begin to merge into one another, and certainly you want to get my August newsletter. If you don't have access to the Internet, I'll be glad to send you either one of the two if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. But you need to get the book, The Minutemen by Jerome Corsi, which will give you the real information you're not going to get elsewhere. Fighting Immigration Advocate by excellent book, and of course our four-tape set on immigration, the DVD, The Conquest of Aslan. You need to have the information. You need to be able to discuss it intelligently. Let me remind you, we are having an all-day seminar on the 29th of this month, 29th of October, Aptos Seascape Golf Course. We're bringing in, of course, Constance Cumby from Michigan. We're going to have Chris Pitto from Southern California, who actually produced the video, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. And there really are secrets out there, and there are secret societies, and there are people who have a different worldview because they worship a different God. And if you don't understand the spiritual forces behind what's going on, you can't understand anything going on in America today. And that's what the big problem is. People really don't understand what's going on. That's why you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and see the video and or the DVD. To understand what's going on in Cuba, you need to see my video. It's called The World Revolution. That's The World Revolution. It includes an uncut version of my personal interview back in 1980 with the American ambassador to Cuba. At the time, your State Department intentionally brought a known communist to power, and his name was Fidel Castro. Hugo Chavez is simply a caricature. He's in office because we want him there. He is a good friend of Fidel Castro. And he's doing exactly what we want him to do, and that is uniting South America in opposition to the gringos and creating a fair and open trade zone, a free trade zone in South America. I mean, everybody, they look like they came from Central Casting. Certainly President Ahmadinejad of Iran, if he didn't come from Central Casting someplace, all the actors are in place. The orchestra is ready. The curtain is about to rise on the final drama. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. It is October 5th, 2006, and I don't think there's any bow to doubt it. Folks are getting sick to death of Mark Foley, Hastert, over and over and over again. Here it is, the chance, just like Scott Peterson.